Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our rooms tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnava.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. I typically like to start my story by asking you guys two questions. One is a very simple one. How many people do we have here that's got less than 1 year sober? Wow. Thank goodness you're here, because that's what helps keep me sober. I appreciate that. How many of you know how to drink liquor? Okay. There's no reason for me to talk about drinking liquor. I will qualify myself so that you understand that when I got here on July the 16th of 1981, at the age of 22, I belonged here. Wrote a few things down so I don't get too carried away with them. Okay, let's see here. First of all, my dad's retired Army, so I spent a lot of my youth traveling from country to country and did not know how to establish relationships with people. So in the process of that, part of what ended up happening to me was that I would isolate and run and hide. That was my MO. Especially whenever I did anything to feel guilty about or shameful about, and that was my life. And part of the results of that is I would end up with situations where here I am living in a cardboard box within 2 weeks of leaving my parents' house at the age of 17, and I have a gun stuck here. Why? Because I want to drink. Now, I don't know about you guys, but that's not something that normal drinkers do, to my knowledge. Another thing that happened to me in the Navy, because that was my way out of that situation, was I blacked out in one continent and came to another 4.5 months later. That's really normal drinking behavior from what I've seen, at least in here. Another one, of course, during that time period is being arrested by the Secret Service. We won't go into the why, other than I was drunk. I needed money. You know, some people print it and sell it, and I bought some. Well, I went from that to where I lived in cardboard boxes, dipsy dumpsters, farmers market stalls, underneath bridges, just anywhere I could sleep because I didn't have a roof over my head. And at that point, I had a pair of overalls, and that was it for clothing. Nothing else, just a pair of overalls. It was the way I existed. It's the way I survived. My parents would drive past me when I was walking down the street and just keep driving. It's as though I didn't exist. And for them, it's not that I didn't exist. It was one of the most difficult things that they'd ever done. They knew that there was nothing else they could do to help me but to let me fall. And that's what they were letting me do. At 2 years sober, I went and thanked them for that, because that helped get me here. Just to kind of make it a little bit lighter than that, one of the other things that I don't think normal drinkers do is I would pull up to a red light with on my motorcycle and forget to put my feet down. So have you ever seen Roland Martin's Laughing with people doing this number? Well, that was me. And I did that quite a bit. And that's part of how I got here. Because I got here from somebody who was going to, she actually worked at a restaurant just in front of a place that used to be called Claremont Lodge. At the time, it was called September Days. It's not there anymore. She was my first wife. And there was these people that would come around noon to 12:30 and have lunch there, and they used to see me drive up, stumble in, or forget to put my feet down. And finally, they started talking to her about, is it possible that this guy is an alcoholic? And of course, they were members of this place called Napa. And one night, she decides to inform me that I'm an alcoholic. And that was not a good thing to do. Because at that time period, I had a severe temper. Still have one, unfortunately. Well, to make a long story short, through the argument that her and I had that evening, now mind you, I don't know what an alcoholic is, but it's beside the point. I was told that I was something, but I was too defiant to listen to it. She ended up crying, and I decided to leave. I didn't deal well with women who cried. And she convinced me to stay against my better judgment, so I did. Well, how do you get a woman to stop crying when you can't handle crying? I did the only thing I knew. I told her if she didn't quit crying, I was going to put the bottle in the TV. She didn't quit crying. So I put the bottle in the TV. She didn't quit crying. That got her to leave, though. I didn't have her crying to deal with anymore. Now, I'm a good drunk. The bottle didn't break. What do you think I did? I poured a drink. A big one. And I proceeded to drink it. And in my mind, I kept having this word alcoholic going back and forth and back and forth like a ping pong ball. And it just kept going and going and going and building. And the more this word kept coming back and forth to me, the bigger it got, the more anxious I got, the more upset I got, the more I drank, and I built it into an emergency. What do you do when there's an emergency? I did the only thing I knew to do when there was an emergency. I dialed 911 and asked them if I was an alcoholic. That's what got me here. Now, I've been told and I've heard through these years that there's nothing that I have done that I won't hear somebody else do. You know, that's one I've yet to hear anybody else do. I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I've yet to hear anybody else have that. Well, the result of that was they got United Way on the phone with me, and I talked to them for, I don't know, 30 minutes to an hour, asking the same question, am I an alcoholic? And they kept telling me they didn't know, but they know where I could find out. And where I could find out was right here at Tampa. So the next morning, this is where I was, 11 o'clock meeting. Sarah was telling her story for Sarah at her first birthday. And I was sitting right back over there by the cake. Didn't realize there was cake there until I went to leave after the meeting and was tracked. I couldn't leave because all these people were around the cake. Oh no, they're going to figure out who I am. I got to get out of here. But somebody told me to keep coming back. So that's what I did. I kept coming back. So what happens, I didn't get here to get sober. I get here to find out if I'm an alcoholic. But I kept coming back because I didn't know what else to do. I'm lost. I mean, I'm absolutely, positively lost. I mean, nobody in their right mind as a drug dealer and drunk calls 911 like I did. I knew something was wrong, but I've always known something was wrong with me. I just didn't know what. And I saw these smiling faces. And I wanted that. You know, I didn't know if I wanted sobriety, but I wanted the smiling faces because what I saw was more smiling from inside. And I had never really known that. I wanted that. So I stuck around. Well, about 4.5 months later, 4.5 months later, I end up at a meeting on a Sunday night on acceptance. I got called on. And I can remember this very, very clearly. I stood up and said, I'm not going to accept it. Turned around and walked out of these doors. To this day, I don't know what the hell I was talking about. All I knew is where I was. I couldn't deal with it. And I hurt. I hurt bad, and I had no idea why. But I wasn't willing to raise my hand and say, help. Couldn't do that. Well, somebody that's a very dear, close friend of mine in this program, Marion, tried to catch me, those who remember her or know her. She couldn't do it. So the next day when I went to work and they were tossing their stuff around, I didn't even think anything of it. It was my second nature. I picked it up and I'm drunk. I mean, I'm drunk enough to where I pick up a six-pack of Coors. There's nothing to refrigerate it with. There's no ice, but hell, I'm a good alcoholic. I grabbed a fire extinguisher. I knew how to cool it down. And I did. I promised myself on my way home that I would not drink. So I found myself at a liquor store buying a fifth. The next day, the same thing. I promised myself I wouldn't drink. I'm drunk. Then again. Well, on that fourth day, I finally got to a place where I could say, help. I didn't want to continue doing this. Because even though I got drunk, I couldn't turn off my head. AA screwed up my drinking. But more than that, I really wanted to live, and I knew that where I was headed. I was headed in a very, very bad place. I've heard enough stories around here that at age 22, I knew that I was a dead man if I continued. And I didn't want to die. But I was too afraid to say help. But I knew one person I could call, and I called him. And that man gave me a very large tool. Because he asked me if I could go till that night to a meeting and not drink. And I told him, hell, I don't know. I want one now. You don't understand. Now, mind you, this man's name was Jason Thompson, probably the lowest bottom drunk I've ever heard. And I'm telling this man that he doesn't understand. Well, he got me to where it was like, can you go 5 minutes without a drink? And I'm honestly telling him, I don't know. I want it now. So I'm a good drunk. He gets me down to a minute. And I get my watch out, and I'm watching the minute hand go by. I said, okay, I made it a minute. Now what? He told me to make it another minute. I'm a good drunk, and I'm watching the minute hand. Now what? After that minute? Well, you know, I must be real bright. Because I asked him once again, now what? But what I learned was I could go a minute without a drink and come right down to it. And if I put 1 minute behind another minute, behind another minute, behind another minute, I could, without intending to, have close to 12,000 days. Because that's where I sit today, close to 12,000 days without a drink. I came back in this program, and I went to somebody up here that I knew very well. It was a Thursday night men's group, which was a very, very, very tough group at the time. Matter of fact, this man here, Stan Parks, used to be there. And I went to this man, and I said, you know, I slipped. Because back in those days, you know, there wasn't near as much as rehab or anything, so the term we used was slip. He was reading his big book. He finishes the paragraph. When he finishes the paragraph, he looked up at me and said, you jumped. And went right back to the big book. I felt about this damn tall. Okay, fine. I struggled through that day. But I kept looking, going, why did he do that? The next day, there was another man that I had a tremendous amount of respect for. I went to him, and I did the same thing. His name was Dow. Dow, I slipped. He looked at me and said, slipped is between shit and syphilis in the dictionary. You jumped. Those who know Dow understand that very well, don't you? And I felt this all once again. But what they did was they took away my excuse. It was something I badly, badly needed. I was using slip as an excuse. The fact of the matter is I jumped, and the reason I jumped is because I wouldn't ask for help. Just wouldn't do it. Well, I have been fortunate enough that I haven't had a drink since then. That was back in July 16th of 81. Now, I've met a lot of good people here, and at that time period, there was a lot of really strong people that I needed that were very, very much older than me, and I used to look at them, yeah, right, they have how many years sober? Which is one of the reasons why I ask the question that I do. I remember sitting in a lot of you people's shoes, listening to a man by the name of Bill Roop, and he said he had 24 years, and what went through my mind is, you lying asshole. I couldn't comprehend 24 years. I couldn't comprehend 3 months. So what I did comprehend, though, is I didn't want to die, which meant I had to be willing to ask for help and then start doing. And I had a problem with doing. I didn't. What the hell do you mean powerless? I'm not powerless over anything. In fact, the matter is I'm powerless over everything. How do you admit that? I didn't know how. I didn't. The only feeling that I could define when I was that early in the program was rage. I couldn't even define anger, but I knew rage. That's it. I could tell you that I hurt, but I couldn't tell you why, and I couldn't tell you what the feelings were behind it. You know, was I remorseful? Was I guilty? I couldn't tell you that. Had no clue. There was a man by the name of Paul Chapelier who spent a lot of time with me my last Friday. And he got me to where I would take 3x5 index cards and each night write down how I felt that day. Now, I couldn't do that, but I would write down what happened, and it was through that process that I started figuring out my feelings. By bringing this up, because one day, all of a sudden, the pen kept writing, and I threw away the postcard, and I just grabbed a piece of paper, and the next thing you know, I've got 10, 12, 15 pages of paper on one subject. And I've got maybe 4 or 5 months over it. That subject was God. Oh, I had deep resentments there. And here it is at the end of all of this, I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, I didn't write this. Where the hell did this come from? Now I'm really feeling lost and confused. What the hell am I supposed to do? And there's a knock on my door because I was living in a certain environment. And I told the person, you know, whoever was at the door, says, come in. Now, mind you, I'm lost. I'm hurting. I don't know what the hell to do with this stack. This person that opens the door, I look up and I just start to laugh. Internally laugh. Because the name of the person who opened the door was Hope. What a coincidence, or was it? Now, here it is. That's what I needed. I needed hope that I could change, that I could live, that I could survive. But how? I couldn't do it drunk, let alone sober, which is part of what I'm going to talk tonight about. How do I survive the mistakes of my sobriety? You see, I only drank for 5 or 6 years. I've got more time in the program than I had drinking. So I've had to learn how to survive sober, but I wasn't doing a very good job with drinking. Hope was part of it. From there, taking that step and going to somebody, because at the time period, my sponsor, who was a very simple man, he knew how to stay sober very simplistically, and I needed that because I complicate things. I asked him if it was okay if I had another sponsor, and he had two. And his response was, yes, as long as you don't play one against the other. So I went and asked this man by the name of Bill Nolan to be my sponsor. He had 9 months sober at the time. Kim and I joked today about I must have really been in my right mind to ask somebody 9 months sober to be my sponsor. And he's been my sponsor for 32 years. And part of the reason why I went to him was that in watching him in this program, I could tell that he did not judge other people for how they felt or what was inside them. He had the ability to accept that for what it was. And I had so much stuff that I had buried and that was so ugly that I was afraid to discuss. I needed somebody that I knew I could absolutely trust without a shadow of doubt. So I went home. Well, Bill thanks me for allowing him to learn how to practice this program for me. Because at the time period, he had never had a sponsee. And it's interesting how the relationship has worked out. Because here it is, I asked him to be my sponsor. He was my sponsor. He became my friend. And today we co-sponsor. And I've never had a dearer friend, except for a couple other possible people. The two people who have changed my life and influenced my life the most, of course, my parents. Besides that, it would be Bill. And there's been some other people here who have been very influential. Stan Parks, Jim Cleveland, just tons of people. I'm trying to get my paper to get where I was, where I wanted to be. Okay. Now, from that point, it was in and around that time period that after getting that big piece of paper out with God, that I decided it was time for a 4-step, and that's what I started to do. And I didn't know how, so Bill and I got the book out, and we started doing a 4-step. Now, mind you, I definitely did not want to share any of that information with anybody, not even Bill. But I did, because I had some things there that nobody had ever heard from me. I was going to take them to my grave, but I was told that it's my deepest, darkest secrets that will keep me drunk. And I believe that to this day. To this day, I believe that. That's why I'm going to share a few things with you. Because our deepest, darkest secrets, my deepest, darkest secrets have caused me many, many issues. But I ended up sitting down with him, doing my fifth step. Now my problem was, you know, it says in the fifth step to do it with somebody else and a power greater than yourself. Well, I find myself in this problem that I really don't have a power greater than myself other than the group of Alcoholics Anonymous and Bill Nolan. So what in the hell am I going to do? I've got to find this thing. What is it? Where is it? How is it? I had no clue. So I started doing my homework. And my homework told me that even though I had an issue with religion, that maybe that's where I need to start. Now, I didn't go to church, but I picked up books. I didn't pick up books on one religion. I picked up books on many religions. What I was looking for was the commonality of them. And if there are a commonality of them in the spirituality that I heard in these rooms, and if so, could that be my power? And the answer to that was yes. I found a power greater than me there. But I also found something else. I had, because one of the nagging questions when I was in that search was, I already had a power greater than me. It was called alcohol. Isn't the fact that what I'm looking for is a power greater than alcohol? And for me, that's what it came down to. I needed a power that was greater than alcohol that I could relate to on a daily basis, or a moment-by-moment basis if I needed to. So it was through the fifth step that I actually found that and started looking for that. Then having to ask questions. Oh my goodness, am I really ready to have defects removed from me? Well, I don't know. What's the way to find out? Have them cause you problems. Because it's when it caused me problems that I was ready. You know, it's one of the things that Bill and I used to talk about. Acceptance is easy when I'm in a position of being acceptable. Well, in the process of all this, I end up with something called a ninth step to do. And I did all the ninth steps that I had except for one. There was one ninth step I just could not do, simply because I didn't know where to locate the individual. I was willing to do it. I just didn't have the ability to find them. Well, that got changed real quick. You see, in the process of all this, I had remarried, and I was married to a woman. Went to an AA conference that I used to go to every year. It was the Atlanta Roundup. And on her and I's fifth wedding anniversary, I'm at a Saturday night speakers meeting, and lo and behold, who do I see but the one person I had not done amends with, my first wife. Now, here's the miracle of this program. The second wife gave me the ability to make the amends to my first wife that night as an anniversary gift. Wow. Man, that just blew me away. How in the hell could something like that happen? Well, it did. And I tell you something else that was kind of funny. I went up to the person and said, you know, can I have a moment of your time? And her response to me is, asked for a minute of her time. Her response to me was to look on her watch and say, 1 minute. I'm like, oh, shit, here we go with the minute stuff again. Well, I ended up sitting at a table. I've got the first one here, the second one here. They're talking about me here as though I'm not present. And it's the most awkward place in the world to be, especially when they're right. So I'm sitting there, I'm listening to this, and back, you know, after about 30 minutes or so of this, I finally look at the first one and ask her if I could speak, and she looked at me and said, is this one of these amends things? And at that time period, she was sober in the program, had a couple of years, and I said, yeah. She's like, okay, as long as it's in a public place. So we went to a restaurant, and we did the amends. I go back to the hotel along with the second one, and we were staying there the night, and we're there with her sister, and we get up the next morning, and I'm old school, ladies first, so let them do their thing, and go to the hospitality suite, and I get myself cleaned up, showered up, go to the hospitality suite, step in, and I'm stopped dead in my tracks, because there's the first wife, there's the second wife, there's the second wife's sister, and I'm like, oh, shit, they're talking, and I'm not present. I had a couple of friends of mine walk up to me and say, are you okay? And I'm standing there going, no, I'm not okay. Well, then I really got fun okay, because the first one got up and started walking to me. And I'm like, and she gets to me and says, I'd like to talk. And I said, well, wait a minute, I got the second one doing this. Okay. So I get outside with her because she wants to sit down privately. And she starts to proceed with, you know, I've been pissed. I've been up all night. You're an asshole. Okay.
And I'm sitting here going, I thought I made the amends properly. I mean, I didn't bring anything of what she did up. It was 100% my responsibility that I got into. I accepted. And, I don't see where I went. This all the stuff's going through my head. What did I do wrong? Then all of a sudden she looks at me and says, the reason I've been so mad is because I've been trying to dig with my sponsor and figure out where I could blame you for doing something wrong, and I can't. I'm like, oh, really? Then I hear her say, my turn. So here it is, by doing a ninth step properly, she's going to make a ninth step with me. All on the fifth wedding anniversary of her second wife. Wow. It was a life-changing event. Gave me a lot of faith in this program. Gave me a lot of faith in the people in this program. The next amendment was a little bit more difficult, I wanted to discuss. It entailed much greater issues. I ended up hurting somebody who was a member of this program. And in the process of hurting that individual, I discovered that you not only hurt other people, but you hurt their family, you hurt their friends, you hurt your family, you hurt your friends. And in the process of this, I was arrested. And of course, during this arrest, they won't let me out on bail. So I'm stuck in DeKalb County Jail while they're building the new one. And I'm like, uh-oh, I'm in deep shit. What do? My natural instincts are to do whatever I can do to get the hell out of this. I've got to get out of this. After 6 months of being in there, and after some really deep soul searching, and of course, I can't talk to anybody specifically about it, because to do so means that I will create a case against me. And I'm not going to do that. So it was between me and God on what am I going to do. Well, here's what I did. I decided to plead guilty and go to prison at 12 years sober. The only amendment I knew to make was to stop injuring by having it continue. The only way I could get out of it was to force somebody to, basically to force somebody to relive it. And that was not acceptable to me. The other issue with that is I had learned enough to know that I had to do what I needed to do to stay sober. And I already knew that if I continued to injure somebody, I would get drunk. So I had to stop it. So I did. That was not a very easy decision to make, Charles. It was very difficult. Now I go to prison, and I've got this guy down in Jackson, while I'm not very far away from the electric chair, telling me that he's going to take me, and he meant it. I've ended up in situations where I needed to make the decision that if the man came in my cell, either him or I was the only one that was going to walk out. Now, how do you live sober and have those decisions to make? And try to practice the principles. I decided to survive, but I did everything that I could do to work with others. And believe me, I had plenty of others to work with. The other thing that I really did a lot of is I replayed the conversations that I had in my mind with Bill. I replayed speaker meetings in my mind because I didn't have meetings available to me. I did all this. And you know, I've always heard worse stories than mine. There's always a worse story than mine. And I lived one in this particular environment. I happened to have a cellmate for a year and a half who, I don't know, anytime he got aggravated, it was like watching a pit bull. I mean, this guy would just go nuts. But he was also like a chihuahua. All he did was bark. But he got a pit bull charge and bark and then back off. And when you watch this, it was almost like watching a caged animal. The man didn't know how to read or write. He was a country boy. He didn't know how to read or write or anything else. Everybody was afraid of him. And I'm stuck in this place with this guy. 6x9 cell. For a year and a half. Come to find out, the reason that it was reminded me of a caged animal is he spent his youth in a cage. He was a caged animal. The reason he didn't know how to read or write, he was only used for labor. And when I left, this man gave me a hug. This is a man that had absolutely no ability to intimately be able to share anything, let alone give another human being a hug. Wished me the best, didn't want me to go. And by that time period, I had him up to the second grade. Wow. And I also worked with a lot of other people there. I ended up in some... you ever seen Shawshank Redemption? I lived it. I'm a software developer, so I developed some software for the state and ended up having inmates thinking that I was working for the man. Oh, my God. That was a trip. You know, so I was in constant issues there. I had some old-timers that were down there that ended up being very close to me because they finally realized that what I was trying to do was help the inmates and at the same time period get through. And, of course, nobody there asked me what I did. And, of course, this is also the time period where the O.J. Simpson trial is going on. And believe me, I was cowering, afraid of the explosions that were going to happen simply because the opinions were so strong on either side. So I lived in a tremendous amount of fear. The question to me wasn't how to survive that. I could survive that easy. The question was, how am I going to survive when I get out? Because when I get out, I have no car, I have no job, I have no nothing. I will have close to 15 years without a drink. How do I face anybody that I do? That was the problem I had to learn how to survive. And I get out, and I start looking for work, and I'm overqualified. McDonald's wouldn't hire me. I was overqualified. So I'm going hungry. So here it is, and of course I'm beating myself over the head, because I'm supposed to be an example of how this program works, and where do I at? So here it is, between my ears, I'm beating myself alive. I ended up going into a temporary agency, and the guy walked up to me and said, "Yes, can I help you?" I looked at him and he says, "I'm an ex-con. Do you have a job?" He looked at me and says, "Are you willing to work?" "Yeah." "So what are you willing to do?" He says, "I don't give a damn." So he had me walk 5 miles to get to a job to unload a truck, knowing for a fact I couldn't get there in time. What he wanted to find out was how far would I get before I gave up. The fact of the matter is, I didn't give up. I called him and told him, I'd call him and let him know I was going to be late and where I was. And from that point, I got a job. And I started working. And slowly but surely, I got to where I could, you know, start eating again, which was quite a step forward. Now, I also have 4.5 years of probation with a probation officer who's informed me that I'm too dangerous for society, therefore, she's going to do everything in her power to put me back in prison. Okay. Now, that's not an easy place to be, but that's where I was. Now, I've looked back many, many, many times over the years and tried to question, how in the hell did I really get through that? What was it that I was doing to get through that? And it was very simple. I had enough of this program ingrained in me that I knew that as long as I put one foot in front of the other and I did the right thing, meaning that I even try to correct the wrongs that I make, that it will be okay. I had to take away the time period of it being okay. But I knew that deep down. And lo and behold, I went through the 4.5 years of probation without an issue. Without one. I also had to spend some time in group psychotherapy. There were some sick folks. I knew some sick folks. I'm sorry, but I did not belong there. But I learned a lot from it. I learned a tremendous amount from it. It used to be right down here on Claremont. I'd go there Monday, and by the time I was done putting the pieces back together from the games that those people played, it would be Friday or Saturday. And it's like, okay, I have one day. Sigh. Here we go again. 4 years of that shit. And at that time period, I had a difficult time coming to meetings. Because, you see, I didn't want this person that I hurt to look over their shoulder. that to me would be continuing harm. But if, with the way the state was and the way this probation officer was, if I found out where this person wasn't going to meetings, I was narrowing down where they were. Because that's the way the state was thinking. That's the kind of shit that they threw at me. So I had this balancing act to do to try to stay sober and yet get to all of this. I started going to the Friday night fights meeting here at 10 o'clock. Figured that was a meeting this person wouldn't show up at. And plus, it was a meeting that Jason, my first sponsor, helped me get involved with. And I can remember sitting there for a couple of years with that meeting and the Saturday night meeting with several people looking at me going, it's obvious this man hurts like hell, but I won't speak up. Because I couldn't. I couldn't let you people know. You guys didn't know me. I was safe. I damn sure couldn't tell you what the hell I was hurting about. Then what would happen? Because nobody in that meeting knew anything about it. You know, then I started running into a few people that did, and it started bothering me. What are they going to say? I run into Marion. She looked at me and says, I heard this rumor. I looked at her and told her to sit down. It's not a rumor. It's the truth. Wow. She said, okay, what have you done to correct it? Told her what I was doing. And her response was, good for you. What can I do to help? Huh? Then I run into Bill Nolan. Same thing. Then I run into somebody else who did me a tremendous, gave me a huge gift. A phenomenal gift. And this day, I don't know if that individual knows it. I'm sitting downstairs at a Thursday night dinner. It was me and Bill, and this person was brought to sit next to us. Bill had to get up and go to a meeting. And when Bill went to that Thursday night meeting at Triangle for the speaker meeting, I have this person that I know or believe knew pretty much the details of everything sitting next to me alone. And I just knew in my gut I was about to get hammered. I also knew that if I got hammered, I was to accept it one time. That person didn't say a word. That person has since called me a brother, given me many hugs, and has treated me no differently than she has ever treated me. Thank you. That's what I was trying to tell you the other day on Facebook. Amazing the gifts of what this program did to the people that are here. See, here it is. I have how much time without a drink, and I've done something that I am very ashamed of. Was willing to accept getting beat verbally over it because that's what it took for another human being to get through what they needed to get through because what I did was that wrong. I'd be okay with it. And to find that I was treated no differently. I can't think of another place on this planet that that's possible. Not one. But I was treated like another alcoholic. There was a big burden lifted off of me then. I didn't look over my shoulder anymore. Now I still had some issues of trying to get through everything. But I didn't have to look over my shoulder anymore. Was somebody going to beat me up? Was I finally going to get what I really deserved? And because I did what I thought was the right thing. And to this day, I can tell you what I did was the right thing. I corrected the error. And it's amazing the relationships that have been established since that time. I ended up, one of the reasons why I ended up at the Tuesday night group for my home group was an individual there that I had asked out on a date and was informed that she wasn't ready. And the way this individual informed me she wasn't ready was walking into the restaurant and start telling me all the reasons why she's just not good enough for a relationship. Just in tears of how she's inadequate and all this other kind of stuff. And I sat there holding her hand, smiling, going, if you only knew that that you know who I am and you really don't want this. So at the end of it, I took her outside, sat down, told her everything, and with me in tears, going, thank you. Somebody had become vulnerable enough to share that deepness in them, I could share mine. And it's since then I've learned how to be very vulnerable with other people and let them know that, hey, we can get through our mistakes sober. And still stay sober. But it means having to do the right things. It means checking what my motives are. What are my intents? You know, I could have easily turned into a martyr. But I went and did everything that I did there to honestly, correctly right a wrong that is unrightable. And I'll never be able to right the wrong. But I haven't repeated it. Well, from there, what ends up kind of happening is you start getting into 10, 11, 12. Those are two nice steps that changed my life, as long as you do it properly. I have since made many more nice steps because I've made many more mistakes, none to that magnitude. But I have made them. You know, I still have a temper. I'm still human. Even with all of these years, I find myself doing things that I sit there and go, where the hell did that come from? You know, it's the fact that I'm human and get busy and get tired and not feel well. I mean, I can still remember some times I've had things happen to me through sobriety that I had no clue I was capable of. An example of that was back in November of 2001, I didn't feel very well. And I had my third wife at the time. We won't go there. I've had three marriages. I've had three divorces. And this year I will probably be married for the fourth time. Well, I mean, we've only been engaged for 4 years. I mean, come on. I told my dad once, three strikes and you're out. Oh, God. Well, it ended up in that month, not feeling well the way I did. The ex-wife, I didn't feel right with her getting out there and doing all the yard work because we had a little over an acre and a tremendous amount of leaves and everything, no matter how I thought I was going to get out there. And so I had bought a new backpack blower and I was going to blow the leaves and burn them and all that good stuff. And all of a sudden, I'm just not feeling well. Well, I have a breathing issue to where when I get around burning plastics, it just takes all the energy out of me. Since this was a new backpack, gas-powered blower, you know, it's the plastic burning off, no biggie. We had some branches that needed to cut, so I mean, I whipped out the chainsaw, fired it up, started cutting. Just got really weak and set the chainsaw down, sat down. And then when I sat down, I was told to get up and go to bed, and I finally agreed, except I couldn't stand up. Instead, what I did is I rolled over to my hands and knees to try to stand up and then hit the ground. I had a massive heart attack. 3 minutes before that massive heart attack, I had a chainsaw in front of me doing this number. Well, here to me is the miracle of all that. I'm laying there in the ICU. They can't get any blood out of me, and believe me, if you can't get blood out of me, there's something wrong. I have the cardiologist walk in. He's like this 6'6", 6'7" guy. He's on this side of me. He looks over at the EKG. He says, "That his?" Yes. He says, "Holy shit." Okay, I knew I was in trouble. They define heart attack, and what I see and what I feel is the horror in my ex-wife's face. I wasn't thinking about me. It wasn't about me. I wanted to get up and give her a hug to get through this guy that was laying here on a table. What a change. Because when I got here, it was all about me. I get out of that, two heart stents. That was a lot of fun. And I wouldn't leave the hospital. That was in Brockville. And when they wanted to transfer me to the cab, I told them I wouldn't leave. Not until I was able to speak to every nurse that took care of me. And they were like, well, the one's over here. We can't go get him. I'm not leaving here until I speak to everyone. okay, and they went and they gone. And I told every one of them, I said, you've got a thankless job, and I don't want to leave here until you know that I appreciate it and thank you for everything that you've done for me. When we get to the cab, I ask the escort, please get flowers, candy, everything. Get them down there. They need a thank you from somebody who really means it. And I didn't complain to them. It was all thank you. Yeah. The guy that was the nurse was a Vietnam vet. And he actually told me that he was watching my heart, and at about 4 o'clock in the morning, it was going all erratic, and all of a sudden, one heartbeat, it was normal. And he looked at me and says, I've never seen anything like it. I said, what is it with you? I don't know. I tell them I'm AA, there's miracles happen all the time. They just kind of look at me funny, but I'm smiling inside going, miracles happen all the time. I'm one of them again. Of course, I could use that word again, 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 and again, because I am. That's part of what sobriety is all about, it's little miracles, little bitty things. Yeah. Now, I get through that. That was a lot of pain emotionally, but at the same time period, very, very tremendous joy. Because before I get out of the camp hospital, Rockdale County, because of all the nurses I had said thank you to, got a spokesman to come see me. I had treated them with kindness. The next thing I know, they wanted to return the favor and go out of their way. Huh? And it's nothing more than trying to live this program. You know, and that's the key to me. It was trying to live this program. Okay. Time's running out. And time is running out. This is a little different than no one tell it. Read real quick. Okay. I'm off. One of the real brief things I'll get into, then I'll try to get to a closing. I had mentioned earlier that my parents used to drive past me and not even acknowledge my existence when I was drinking. The relationship changed there, I briefly wanted to touch base on. My mother had acute emphysema, 4 heart murmurs, etc. It was easier to say what was right with my mother health-wise than what was wrong. And we watched her die for 15 years. It was a very slow, agonizing, painful death. She had had a pacemaker put in, and the battery on her pacemaker went out. And I asked Mom one day, when she told me this, she said, well, do you want to go in and get it replaced? And she said, no, I can't take it anymore. Which basically says, my mother said she was going to go ahead and die. And I'm like, okay, what can I do? She said, treat me like you've always treated me. And don't tell anybody. Because my dad would have fought with her, and she didn't want that battle going on. I'm like, okay, that's not a problem. Now, how do you treat somebody that you know can't breathe but likes to laugh? That's asking to treat them as you normally would. If they laugh, they laugh. If it hurts, it hurts. So there was an earthquake on the Alabama-Georgia line in the middle, and you could feel it all the way to middle Georgia. This earthquake happened. I felt it. I picked up the phone and I got to giggling. And I put the phone down and said, no, I'm going to wait and call my mom tomorrow because I'm going to pull a joke here to have. Next morning, I dial my mom's phone. She picks it up and says, Mom, are you okay? She said, yeah, why? I said, well, I figured you and Dad had sex. The ground moved. Now, I knew when she started laughing that this was going to hurt her. But at the same time period, it's like, how could I be with my mother and be and treat her like I always have? Sure enough, it didn't take 5 minutes and the phone went click. About four and a half later, hours later, when she got her breath back, she finally called back and said, that was good. I have to remember that to your father. Well, she ended up in the hospital, so when we took her out of the hospital to die at home, it took about a year because they had to change the battery in her pacemaker, so the pacemaker kept her alive. It was like watching a zombie. I mean, it was very, very ugly. And I remember looking at my dad one night, and I looked and says, she's not going to make it very long. He was on the phone with my brother and says, if my brother wants to be here when she passes, you better tell him to move it now. And he was like 10 minutes away, and I says, I don't think he'll make it. And my dad and I's relationship, because of my prison, was not very good. My dad never forgave me for that. And I understood why, and it was okay. I could live with it. And I say that because here it is, there's a man that I could be very, very angry with and hold resentments, etc., for the way he treated me from that point on. Then I'm sitting there. And here's his wife of 49 years dying, and I knew she was going to go, but I couldn't get him to stop long enough to hold her hand when she passed, except for to let him to prove me wrong. This program gave me the ability to do the right thing and to make sure that when she passed, he was holding her hand. What a beautiful, beautiful thing. It was not easy, but it was the right thing to do. A very loving thing for me to do. I'm going to close it up because time's running out. I've always had a problem ending my story. And part of the reason for that is because I've always... I'm 32. What can I end? And I decided that part of the reasons I also had a difficult time ending a story is because this program's taught me that with every ending, there is a beginning. So as I end this evening, I end telling you that life couldn't be better in many ways. I mean, I probably will be married this year. Yes, thank you. That's as long as the promises continue. Sure. And with that, I hope that your sobriety begins another moment, another hour, and another day. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.